Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page and sign up for the Here We Still Stand conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's going to be October 15th and 16th. It's only $65 to come hang out with us for 2 days, and it includes your lunch. We'd love to see you there. There's a link in the show notes, or you can just go to the website, find the event, and register. Chad, last week, Absalom's plot came to fruition. He's assembled all the people together. He's stolen a bunch of hearts. He's coming into town, and David's leaving town because David is not interested in going to war with his son. He also is not certain that he has enough backing at this point to be successful. And so, for the sake of the city, and I think he knows that if he did this, the city itself would suffer greatly if he were to fight with Absalom. He decides that it's better if he just leaves. And so he leaves, but he does have one spy in the midst of Absalom's inner circle of counselors. And so that's sort of where we ended.
Yeah, that closing verse of chapter 15 has Hushai, David's friend, his kind of friend and friend slash counselor, goes into the city. At the same time, we're told that Absalom is going into the city. Now, we're going to have to wait until chapter 17. We're at chapter 16 now. We'll have to wait until chapter 17 to find out exactly what happens when, it's later in chapter 16. We'll find out exactly, you know, what kind of conversation happens between Hushai and Absalom. Because, you know, right now, if we're just kind of reading this, we're not sure. I mean, is Absalom going to be suspicious of Hushai? Is he going to be like welcoming of him? What kind of reception is Hushai going to get? So we'll get to that a little bit later in this chapter. For now, we have to find out what happens with some other people that come to David. So in chapter 15, a lot of people are coming up to David saying, hey, we're on your team. We're with you. He's got his inner guard. He's got some other people from kind of the Philistine quarter who have joined up with him. And, of course, he had Hushai that we just talked about. So he's going to encounter somebody else. And this is kind of a fascinating question that arises in these first few verses of chapter 16. Because, I mean, I'm pretty sure that I know the motives of this guy we're about to encounter. His name is Ziba. But there's still a bit of a question mark. So this is the way it starts out. Chapter 16 says that David passed a little beyond the summit, that is the summit of the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem. And when he does this, this guy named Ziba, who is the servant of Mephibosheth, met him. He's got a couple of donkeys already saddled. He's got all this food. He's got 200 loaves of bread. He's got 100 bunches of raisins. He's got 100 of summer fruits. And then he's got some wine. So you can kind of see David. He's walking along. You know, they're trying to get out of the city, and all of a sudden this guy shows up. David knows who he is. He's got all this stuff, all the food and the wine and the donkeys. And so David says to him, "Why have you brought these?" And Ziba answers him, "Well, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on. So, you know, I brought you some transportation here," because David is on foot, remember. "And then the bread and the summer fruit are for the young men to eat." So he's got them some transportation. He's got them some food. "And the wine is for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." So transportation, food, and wine. The king says to him, so David says back to him, "Where is your master's son?" And he's talking about Mephibosheth. We'll review who he is in just a second. So where's he at? Where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba says to him, and this is the line that raises all kinds of questions, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said," now keep in mind, this is what kind of a "he said that he said" kind of situation. So Ziba says that Mephibosheth said, "Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father." So we'll return to that in just a minute. We'll try and figure out the either truthfulness or falsity of that. So the king responds to him. Obviously, David is going, David believes him, because David says then to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And then to wrap this up, into verse 4, Ziba responds, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king."
Okay, let me tell you exactly how long I believe that this is true. Exactly, exactly as long as it took me to read Ziba's response. And that's when you know, like, I think this guy's lying. Here's why this guy, you think that I think this guy's lying. One, what sense does it make that Absalom, who's going to try to overthrow his father, is coming in, and Mephibosheth's like, "Oh, good, now the kingdom can go back to the house of Saul"? That doesn't make any sense at all. Does he think that Absalom's just going to be like, "Oh, there's someone from the house of Saul here. Well, I guess you're king now"? That's not going to happen. Yeah. Why, no, what makes him think Absalom's going to give him anything? I mean, he should be freaked out that somebody not David from David's house is taking over, because he was already freaked out that David might have him executed just to eliminate any, you know, other claims to the throne. He doesn't know what Absalom's going to think about having a descendant of Saul hanging around. Absalom kind of seems like the guy that might not be into that. That makes no sense that he would be have these thoughts, that he would be excited about someone else taking the throne. Makes no sense at all. And Ziba, you know, if he's Ziba's thinking, well, maybe I could get on the good side of David by being like, "Yeah, I don't know, man. Mephibosheth, he's still hanging out there," and he thinks that this is going to turn out really great for him. David is surprising in his old age at how
he seems gullible, doesn't
he? Yeah, how willing he is just be like, "Well, if that's true," and you're like, "Dude, wait, no, not if that's true. Think about that for a second. Like, that's probably not true."
Yeah. I suspect the only reason that, maybe not the only reason, but the primary reason he believed it is just because of the situation that he's in. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. It's like, okay, you know, he's got all this stuff going on. He's got all these people who are stabbing him in the back. And so even though this doesn't, if you think about it for 5 seconds, it makes no rational sense. David is so overcome by all these people who are betraying him that when somebody says, "Oh yeah, you know what? Mephibosheth also has betrayed you," he's like, "Oh, there's one more who's against me."
Yeah.
Even though it doesn't make any sense that that's actually the case. So just to, if you're thinking to yourself, okay, I forgot who these guys are, go back to 2 Samuel chapter 9, so a few episodes back. And David was in the mood for doing good. And so he's like, "Hey, is there anybody left from Jonathan's household that I can show mercy to?" And somebody says, "Yeah, his son, the one who is handicapped in his feet, named Mephibosheth. He was dropped when he was a young child, and his feet were badly injured, and so he has been unable to walk all these years." And so David says, "Bring him in." So they bring him in, and he's scared at first. Like you said, he thinks David's going to kill him. And David's like, "No, I'm going to do quite the opposite. I'm going to take care of you." And here's so this is when Ziba enters the picture. Ziba had been a servant of Saul. And so now David says to Ziba, who was quite evidently a prosperous man, he's like, "All right, you are now going to be the servant of Mephibosheth, and you're going to take care of him." So all this time, we didn't know anything negative about him at that point. All we know is that he was the one charged with being, him and his family were the servants of Mephibosheth. So evidently, and there was no question of the loyalty of Mephibosheth either. But anyway, evidently Ziba is taking advantage of the tumultuous situation that David finds himself in order to come out and basically stab his master in the back. Because how's the guy going to get to David and you know, tell David actually the truth? He can't get there. So,
well, not only he can't get there, as in like literally can't get like. So you have a guy who's lame in his feet. He's not going to come riding out, you know, to meet David. Be like, "I'm on your side, man. I'm with you." Like, this is not something he's going to do. Any messengers that are sent, Ziba can say they're lying. The only way for David to really find out that this is not true is for him to go back to where Mephibosheth is, which he cannot do because that's where Absalom is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so now I'm not going to give it away. If you want to go read ahead of time, read ahead, you can do that. I'm not going to give it away as to what happens when all of this is resolved and David comes back. But even that is fascinating. So we will get there. We'll get there eventually. But so there's like three episodes with these guys. The first time we met Mephibosheth and Ziba when becomes a master-servant relationship. Now the servant tries to become the master, and at least at this point is successful. And then eventually we're going to encounter these two guys again. So we'll see what David's decision is going to be at that point. Okay, so David is progressively moving outside of Jerusalem, and he's got, you know, he's in all these encounters along the way. He's encountered his inner guard, who are from the Philistine quarter, and he's encountered the priest and their sons, and now he's encountered this servant from the household of Saul back in the day. And now we're going to encounter a guy who is mad with rage. So beginning with verse 5, we're going to be introduced to a guy whose name is Shimei. And talk about a person who is full, just drunk with rage at David. That's who this guy is. So verse 5 says that King David came to a place called Bahurim. And there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul. So that tells us immediately that maybe there's going to be some issues here, because he has this connection to the man that David replaced. And his name is Shimei. He's a son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. So this guy, he's got to be maybe drunk with rage is actually the best way to think about it. Because, you know, when people are intoxicated, they do some pretty stupid things. They do some very dangerous things that could really get them hurt or even killed, because they're not thinking rationally. Well, this guy, he's by himself. There you have David, you have all his mighty men surrounding him. And this guy is not only verbally attacking David, he's actually picking up rocks and throwing them, not only at David, but all his servants. And by the way, the verb that is used in Hebrew for throw stones, I did a search, and maybe with one or two exceptions, invariably, this is the verb used when you stone someone, like stone them in execution style. So this is sort of a mock execution that is going on here. So he's not just like picking up rocks and throwing them. He's like, it's like a mock execution. So he's cursing him. He's throwing stones at him. And this is what he says, verse 7. This is the curse. He says, get out. You man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. Now in Hebrew, when blood is referenced with regard to like murder or bloodshed, it occurs in the plural. That's just so bloods literally, but when Hebrew wants to say that someone is guilty of bloodshed or guilty of murder or something like that, the plural will be used, which is what we find here in the Hebrew. So you're not just like a man who happens to have, you know, who happens to be a warrior. You are a man with blood on your hands, more or less. And worthless man is a word that we've encountered before, you know, like the sons of Belial. This is the same Hebrew behind that there.
Yeah, man of blood does not mean that you like happen to have served in the military.
It means you're a murderer.
Yeah, it means that you're a murderer.
Yeah, this is the same word that occurs in Genesis 4 when the blood of Abel is crying out. Literally in Hebrew, it's the bloods, because the plural is used there to indicate that murder has happened.
It's interesting. Now, David being a man of blood, not untrue. Even God will say this of David, like, you're not going to build my house because you're a little bit of a murderer, you know. So
yeah.
That's not
to, not to mention the whole story of Uriah. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, you've got some of that. But what is interesting is that this guy is saying that the Lord is like doing this to David with his son, to avenge the blood of the house of Saul. That's wild. It makes you think that must be some like rumors going around, and people are starting to say like, well, you know how David really got the throne. Because what you can accuse David of is going around like murdering the house of Saul. He could have killed Saul many times, didn't do it. Him and Jonathan were boys. He was good to Mephibosheth. I mean, so there's not David's got blood on his hands, but it isn't that blood.
Yeah. So he's right, generally speaking, but he's completely wrong with regard to the details.
And this definitely isn't happening because God is punishing David for how he interacted with Saul. That is not at all correct.
Yeah. I mean, how many times do we encounter situations where David could easily have shed the blood of Saul? And probably no one would have blinked. I mean, everyone would have been like, yeah, man, that guy had it coming. He was running after you, chasing you, throwing spears at you, taking away your wife, doing all these things. You had every right to take him out. But of course, David wouldn't do that because he wouldn't touch the Lord's anointed. And he even executed some people who claimed that they had, the one guy who claimed that he had killed Saul. The charges, the specific charges are completely wrong. It was not by bloodshed, it was not by murder that David was able to become king. Quite the opposite. This is exactly what God had decreed should happen. But like you say, that being true and that being accepted as true by the general population are two different things. So I suspect there was to use the buzzword today, there was a different narrative going around about how David actually came to the throne. And some people, you know, they thought that he had done it by violence and by taking away the kingdom of Saul. So anyway, that's the kind of accusations that he's hurling while he's also hurling rocks in the general direction of David. Then verse 9, I was trying to think of a character description of what's about to happen here. Because you know, if you've read novels, you've watched movies where like the main character has a sidekick, and the sidekick is kind of a rough guy, and like violence is always his first option. Like if something needs to be done, he's gonna be like, hey, you want me to go beat him up? Or hey, you want me to take him out? It's just like the first thing that always pops into his mind is the violent option. Well, that's Abishai in verse 9. This, by the way, remember, is Abishai is one of David's nephews. He's been with him all along here as a brother of Joab and the son of David's sister. So Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head. So true to form, this is Abishai. I'm like, every time he comes up, he's like ready to kill somebody. So he's, you know, ready to go chop off this guy's head. And the king says, this is also one of these scenes we've seen elsewhere where the main character's like, just calm down, chill. No, let's not be chopping off heads. David says, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? I get the feeling that David is just done with all of his nephews. Just like ready to just send them somewhere where he doesn't have to deal with them on a daily basis. But no, his response is after that is interesting. He says, if he's going back to the guy who's cursing him here, Shimei. If Shimei is cursing because the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? And so David goes on to say to Abishai and to all his servants, look, my own son. In Hebrew, this is even more graphic. It's like, doesn't just say my own son. It's like he who came forth from my own innards is. So it's just like, it's this language of someone who is my own flesh and blood, we might say. Behold, my own son and my own flesh and blood, he seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite, let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. And just to kind of wrap up the section. So David and his men, they go along on the road, and Shimei, he's on the hillside opposite them, and he's just cursing. He's throwing rocks. He's flinging dust. And the king and all who were with him, they arrive weary at the Jordan, and there they get some rest. There they refresh themselves.
Yeah, it seems to me that David's just done. I mean, he doesn't have that thing in him right now. He just left the city. He doesn't want to fight. He doesn't want to fight with Absalom. He doesn't want to like start killing people in the street that like are saying bad things about. He's just done, man. He's just like, well, look, if people are gonna curse you, they're gonna curse you. I'm just trying to get out of here. Like, I'm not interested in like killing a bunch of people along the way. Bloodshed and among the people is actually the whole thing I was trying to avoid in the first place. So, you know what? I can handle the insults, and if God's told him to do it, then who's to stop him? If God hasn't told him to do it, well, maybe God will do something good for me for enduring this sort of persecution.
I do think that's where David's at. He's done with so many things. He's done with his nephews. He's had to deal with Joab, and now he's having to deal with this with Abishai, who's ready to chop off the guy's head. And so, yeah, he is at that point where he's just ready to kind of get past all this. So I was looking at the commentary, or kind of the retelling of this story by Josephus. And so Josephus was a Jewish historian from right after the time of Jesus, so kind of late first century. And one of the books he wrote was called The Antiquity of the Jews, where he basically just retells the story of the Old Testament. And when he gets to this part, I thought it was kind of humorous, actually, the way that Josephus interprets what's happening here and why David responds the way that he does. So these are the words that he puts in David's mouth about this cursing and whatnot. Josephus writes, "So is it any wonder that I'm obliged to undergo these abuses," like the verbal abuses from this Benjaminite? "What is it any wonder that I'm obliged to undergo these abuses from him while I experience the like from an impious son of my own?" So in other words, listen, if I had to put up with all this from my own flesh and blood, it's no wonder that I got to put up with it from the likes of this guy who's from the tribe of Benjamin and connected to the household of Saul. So no shocker. He hates me. My own son evidently hates me. And so I'm going to let God sort this out. You know, if God told him to curse me, I guess God wants me to be cursed. If God didn't tell him, well, then we'll see what happens in the end. One other thing here. I don't think that we brought this up so far. So if you look at verse 13, it says, "So David and his men went on the road while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him." And there's a cool thing that happens here in the Hebrew text. So if you were reading along in the Hebrew, you know, word after word after word, when you got to the gap between on the road and while Shimei, there's a gap in the Hebrew text. Just a bigger space than normally would be between words. And the Hebrew letter samek is inserted in there. Now, this is an indication, at least a lot of people think this is an indication, that kind of in between, in the middle of this sentence, is where we should understand a certain prayer that's been prayed, or the context in which a certain prayer should be heard. Now, here, in the middle of this verse, while all this is going on, while Absalom is coming into town and Shimei is cursing him and he's heading to the Transjordan area, the Hebrew scribes who copied this understood that what should be kind of understood as prayed here is Psalm 3. So if you go, as you know, people know, I'm sure, that many of the Psalms are explicitly connected with certain events in the life of David. Psalm 51, of course, is the one that is most well known. But if you go to Psalm 3, what you read in the introduction is this: a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. So Psalm 3 is pretty short. It's only 8 verses. But in the Hebrew, that little gap that I was talking about is understood to indicate that, hey, Psalm 3 is best prayed and understood and interpreted within this particular context. So that's kind of a cool thing that we, you know, we can't see from English translations. Maybe some commentaries bring it out. But check out Psalm 3 and you'll see how what David prays there is actually does perfectly fit this particular context. He talks about those who are cursing him. He talks about the dangers that he faces. And most importantly, he talks about how God is going to sustain him in the midst of his trials and then bring him back and give him salvation and blessing. Okay, now we're at verse 15, so let's see what happens after that. So David and his men are at the Jordan. They're having some rest from fleeing that far, and we're going to go now back. So the scene's going to shift. We're going to go back to Jerusalem and see what happens when Absalom gets there. So Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. Now Ahithophel, remember, was this counselor that had gone to the other side, gone to the dark side, we might say, had betrayed David. And when Hushai, the Archite, so back to this friend of David, so when Hushai, the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king, long live the king." Now, Absalom is understandably hesitant to believe that Hushai is actually going to be on his side. So Absalom says to him, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why didn't you go with your friend? No, what are you doing here? Why didn't you go with David? You're his friend. You're his trusted counselor. So Hushai says to Absalom, "No, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you." Actually, pretty kind of a sneaky language it's used here. And commentators have pointed this out, that when you read through his speech to Absalom, it's not till you really get to the very end where he makes it explicit that he's talking about Absalom. Because if you just take the opening phrase, "Long live the king, long live the king," well, he actually could be talking about David there. He's speaking to Absalom.
Yeah.
But he's saying, "Hey, long live the king, long live the king." Now at the end he says, "Listen, as I served your father, so I'm going to serve you." And presumably Absalom was convinced.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the right way to do it. He doesn't go in and make up this whole thing about like, "Well, actually, you know, I'm not that loyal to David. David's kind of terrible." He actually leans into the loyalty, because apparently Absalom's like, "Hey man, aren't you guys..." It almost sounds like initially Absalom's like a little offended for like, "Hey, don't you have any honor, man? Like, what are you doing here?
Yeah, where's your loyalty?
Yeah, what are you doing here?" And what he does is he actually like flips that loyalty and says, and basically says, "You can trust me because of that. Like, I just serve whoever the king is, and the people have chosen you to be king. So now I'm serving you. And just like I was loyal to your father when he was king, as long as you're king, I'll be loyal to you." And this seems like something Absalom can buy.
Yeah, it's like his loyalty is not to the person, but to the office, I guess you might say. "Listen, I'm loyal to the king. And if the king is David, or if the king is you, Absalom, or if the king is going to be one of your sons, whoever it is, as long as I live, my loyalty is to the office and not to the individual who occupies."
Yeah, it's like one of those, it's like, you know, a politician who, you know, is just there to serve the country, right? So he's saying like, "Hey, I just serve Israel."
Right. That's it. "I'm the servant of Israel. I'm not the servant of any particular Israelite." Mm-hmm. Just there to do my duty for the country. So, it evidently works. And as we'll see when we get to chapter 17, it works extremely well, especially when you realize that Hushai is no simpleton when it comes to giving speeches. He is very rhetorically talented, as we will discover. He's evidently like David in that he can convince people to come to his side. So right now, Absalom has some decisions that he has to make, and so he gathers around him his kind of his national security advisors, I suppose. And he at least has two of those. He has Ahithophel, and he's going to lean pretty heavily into him. But now he has Hushai as well. So Absalom says to Ahithophel, "Give your counsel. What shall we do?" So David and his supporters have fled, and we're in Jerusalem. So what do you think? What's the first thing that we should do? And Ahithophel says to Absalom, go, this is crazy. This is the first thing that he suggests. Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Remember, we referenced those a couple episodes ago, these 10 women who were left behind. So go into those 10 women, your father's concubines, that he's left behind. And here's the result. All Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father. So you're going to stink to your father in doing this. And so that's going to happen. And the other result is the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. So what happens? Well, they pitch this tent. They didn't do this in some sort of like public sexual sort of way. They did at least pitch a tent for Absalom on the roof. We got to come back to that because the location of this is significant. On the roof. And Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. And now in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed both by David and by Absalom. This is a pretty wild scene. You might be asking yourself, it's a weird first act to do. I mean, of all the things that you first get into Jerusalem, what do you think I should do first? I mean, should I like check and see how many weapons we have in the armory? Should I check our supplies? Should I see how many men I have? What exactly should happen? And Ahithophel's like, oh, I know exactly what you should do. Pitch a tent on your dad's roof, take his 10 concubines, have sex with them. That's the first thing that you should do.
Yeah, that is sort of like orgy in front of like all of Israel is a weird move.
It's a very weird move. Now, it is weird, but I think a couple things could help us to understand why this is done. First of all, and I don't remember if this has come up in previous episodes or not. I know that you and I have talked about this. It helps a little bit to understand that Ahithophel is, and this is almost 100% certain. There's a little bit of dispute with regard to some name changes, but we're almost certain that Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba. So this could be that what's going on here is Ahithophel is getting back at David for the whole mess that he caused that we read about. And that also might help to explain why it happened on the roof. Because the rooftop is exactly where, of course, David saw Bathsheba when she was bathing. So there is a sense here in which you get the feel that Ahithophel is not simply being an official counselor, but he is, as it were, getting revenge for everything that David did. So that's one reason. Another is, and this helps us to understand actually some other episodes that we encounter both previous to this and after this. So you may remember that way back in the book of Genesis, Jacob's firstborn had sex with one of Jacob's co-wives. And when we talked about that way back then, one of the points that we made is that in the ancient world, when you wanted to basically say, I'm the guy in charge, I should be the leader now, one of the things that you did was you kind of acted this out sexually. So by taking the wife or the concubine or the co-wife of the guy who was in charge and having sex with her, this was your way basically of saying, I'm the one that everybody should be looking up to. I'm the one who now has the authority. So this is a sexual act, of course, but it's more than that. This isn't just about, you know, some sort of lust or something. This is a, I don't know what you want to call it, kind of a ritual slash political move on Absalom's part, whereby he, in having sex with these concubines of David, is saying, I'm the guy. I'm the one who's now in charge. So it wasn't just a kind of a twisted display of his sexual prowess. This is his way of saying, I, and not my father, I am now the king.
Yeah, you're basically letting everyone know that everything that belonged to your father now belongs to you.
Yeah, that's it. So you might be saying, well, okay, that message is clear, but what's this about you know, you'll make yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. I think what also is happening here is that by doing this very, very public act, very political act, the message is going to be sent to anybody who kind of like might be in a neutral position, like, I don't know, which side should I choose? You know, should I choose the Absalom side? Should I choose the David side? I really don't know what's going to happen, so I don't want to make the bad decision. This is going to force them to make a decision. Since Absalom's going to be odious, a stench in the nostrils of his father, any hesitation that somebody might have thinking, oh, you know what? It could be possibly that David and his son could reconcile, but that's going to be shot. There's no way that's going to happen. By doing this, any chance of a peaceful reconciliation has been annihilated. So anyone who is kind of on the fence here is going to have to get off the fence. They got to make a decision. And as a result of that, the hands of all who are with him will be strengthened. So that's why Ahithophel proposes to Absalom to do what he does. And as it says there at the end of that chapter, his counsel was regarded as if it was basically divine. Everybody kind of trusted Ahithophel to give the wisest advice.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to say that both David and all the people and Absalom, they all like, sort of thought this whatever this guy said was what you this is what you should do. So his reputation is that of someone who gives you very, very good counsel. So even as like maybe strange as this would seem to do, they're like, well, this guy's like never wrong.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, he's one of those people that if he says it, well, okay, that's what we gotta do, you know. Now that actually sets us up for what's gonna happen in the opening chapter of 17, because knowing this about the counsel of Ahithophel, that it was regarded as just almost unquestionable, that everybody always did what Ahithophel suggested. That then, when we go into the next chapter, is going to lead us to believe that when he makes a suggestion to Absalom as to how they should proceed militarily, that of course Absalom would go with what he says. But as we'll see, that's not what happened. So by elevating Ahithophel to this almost divine status as far as his counseling goes, that means that his fall, which we'll read about later, his fall is going to be that much more dramatic.
Yeah, and it seems that they made it known to the people what was happening was suggested by Ahithophel, because I mean, there's no reason to bring up all the people, you know, really respected this advice. So this is another sort of way to get all the people on your side. You know, if you're like riding in with this guy and you're saying, you know, Ahithophel has said to do this and this is what I'm going to do, people are like, well, like, okay, that's what that is. It seems that Absalom initially is, and this is a smart thing to do, is using him to lend credibility to this whole thing. Ahithophel, he did not go with David, right? He stayed. Just probably the right thing to do is to support Absalom.
Yeah, I think that's probably what's happening here, is that he lends a lot of credibility to Absalom, not just with regard to his advice, but also just the fact that he has not gone with David, but that he stayed with Absalom. He's probably, if he's regarded this highly by all the Israelites, there's probably no greater gift that Absalom could have received besides his betrayal of David.
Yeah.
And this is the guy that you want to come over to your side if anybody's going to come over to your side.
That's it. All right. Next week, we will get into what the recommendation is for pursuing David and how that all goes down. But you'll have to wait until then. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.